And on behalf of my colleague, Dr. Syed Tatar, I'm so delighted that you've all joined us for Food Hygiene, Still a Relevant Nosocomial Issue. In 2003, the annual Congress of the International Federation of Infection Control was held in Malta, which is, of course, a small Mediterranean island south of Italy. The man who chaired that incredibly successful conference is our speaker today. It is my pleasure to introduce my friend, Dr. Michael Borge. Dr. Borge himself is a man of tremendous influence. Being a board member with the International Federation of Infection Control, he gets to several developing countries and to the annual Congress. He serves on several pan-European committees and associations that deal with infection surveillance, antibiotic resistance, and infection control. And he is a consultant to the Maltese Food Safety Commission on foodborne disease transmission. And also, he is a really great guy. Now, before Dr. Borge begins, I would like to note our teleclass sponsor and thank them very much. Scott McNeil and his gang at Johnson Diversey are sponsoring this teleclass today. Johnson Diversey was the very first teleclass sponsor, and they kept us financially supported right back in the early days in 2001 and 2002. They've been very good friends all along. Thank you very much, guys. You do good stuff. Now, to present the teleclass, Food Hygiene, Still a Relevant Nosocomial Issue, I give you Dr. Michael Borge. Michael.
Thank you, Paul. It's probably good afternoon and good evening to most online. It is a pleasure for me to participate in this excellent teleclass series that Paul and Syed have put together. It's a privilege to be here. And as already stated by the chair, what I will be discussing today is a topic which I would say is not mainstream. It is not something you are likely to encounter in the vast majority of infection control symposia and infection control congresses. Nevertheless, I believe that food hygiene is still important. It is still an issue that interests and should grasp the attention of infection control professionals, whether they are in developing or in developed world settings. So, therefore, my topic and the first slide I hope you have in front of you is the title of the presentation, and this is what it therefore is trying to prevail. Food hygiene is still a relevant nosocomial issue today in the 21st century. If we can go to the next slide, please. What I will be trying to cover in this 55 minutes is, first of all, the relevance and impact of foodborne illnesses in hospitals worldwide. And I will be referring both, as I said, to high-income countries, as well as limited resource settings. But in both situations, food hygiene, since food is a universal issue, are both important. I will then pass to look at some aspects of the role of infection control teams and infection control professionals in hospital food hygiene, and what interventions they may be required to provide. And then follow this up with an overview on food hygiene fundamentals. It's obviously impossible to do it in this time allotted, but I will try to pick up the most critical points. And finally, I will conclude the presentation with a look at food hygiene in wards, with a special attention given to enteral feeding, where problems of food hygiene may occur. Can we go to the next slide, please? Now, the problem of food poisoning and foodborne illnesses within low-resource countries, within the developing world in general, is quite well documented. Even though there is a general lack of epidemiological infrastructures in these settings, and as a result, surveillance may not be as effective as it would be in other locations. Nevertheless, it is generally acknowledged that infectious diseases are highly prevalent in the community within these countries. And therefore, it is not surprising that many instances of foodborne illnesses in hospitals in developing countries occurs by transmission of pathogens from the community into hospital, where they can then be further transmitted endemically in the hospital by means of a food vector. An additional problem of developing countries involves the high prevalence of HIV in many patients in hospital settings, and it is well recognized that food poisoning and gastrointestinal disease, infections in general, are more serious and more common in HIV patients. How prevalent are foodborne illnesses in developing countries? Well, as I said, there is very often a lack of epidemiological infrastructure, which does not provide extensive information. But from the few snippets that one can find in the literature, it appears that the problem is quite high. In fact, a paper by Payton and colleagues estimated the prevalence of nosocomial salmonella in Kenyan hospitals at around 3%, with Shigella in close proximity at 2.5%. In addition, another assessment in India indicated that up to 20% of hospitalized children in the hospitals under study were at risk of an enteric infection. So undoubtedly, it is a significant problem. Next slide, please. What about, however, nosocomial food poisoning and foodborne illnesses in developed countries, in countries of a high resource environment? Well, very often there is a substantial lack of awareness of these issues in the West, mainly because we now assume that food safety and food hygiene is a state of fact, and it should always be there. However, if you look again at limited information available, you will find out that this is not always the case. A study in the United Kingdom by Joseph and colleagues, in fact, identified 248 outbreaks of nosocomial salmonella in UK hospitals over the 10-year study period of the investigation. Wall et al. Estimate that nosocomial infections account for up to 15% of all outbreaks of food poisoning reported in the United Kingdom. In addition, it is not only a question of commonality. How common are these situations? There is also an element of cost, and cost obviously is a major issue in infection prevention. And once again, nosocomial outbreaks of foodborne illnesses cost significantly. They cost significantly because they require manpower interventions, which can be quite extensive, and they also require numerous laboratory analyses as part of the outbreak investigation and control effort. And this can be extensive. In fact, Spearing in Australia, investigating one such outbreak of nosocomial salmonella, costed it to have required an input, an expenditure of not less than 120,000 Australian dollars. So this is undoubtedly a significant fact. We can go to the next slide. In addition, again, because of this perception that food safety should be automatic in the West, whenever outbreaks occur in hospitals, especially if those outbreaks are associated with instances of severe morbidity and especially mortality, then the public takes notice and takes notice very dramatically. As you can see, this is one such outbreak in a Glasgow hospital occurring in the year 2002, involving at least three cases of death in the hospitalized patients. And if we can go to the next slide, an inquiry into the management of this outbreak identified a number of lacunae, a number of discrepancies in the way that the outbreak was managed. And these included issues such as lack of clarity between the different stakeholders, confusion as to who should be involved and take the lead in such situations, internal policies, and very importantly, a reluctance to communicate with the public, until obviously forced to do so by external pressure from the extensive media coverage. And if you look at the report, it is clear that people were taken by surprise. They were not expecting that in the 21st century, they would actually have such a large outbreak with so significant consequences. So it's important for infection control professionals to be aware of this, albeit not common, but important circumstances. If we can go to the next slide. If you look again at this report, there are a number of recommendations which show the way and give us some clues as to what is required in order to avoid such a circumstance as unfortunately experienced in Glasgow. And the authors of the report make it very clear that if it is a serious situation, if there is death amongst patients, if there are major implications for public health, and especially if there is major public anxiety and concern, then in this case, a major outbreak plan should be instituted. This should not be retained in-house as a normal infection control investigation. In such a circumstance, it is important to bring in as many useful stakeholders as possible. So individuals like environmental health officers, individuals like consultants in communicable disease control in the community, and also very useful would be trained media liaison officers who would actually take a burden off the infection control team in communicating with the public and with the press. On the other hand, if the outbreak is reasonably contained, if the amount of infections, if the amount of cases is minimal, if there is minimal impact on public health and no appreciable public anxiety and concern, then in that case, and they're obviously assuming that the infection control team has the necessary awareness on food safety issues, has the necessary training in food hygiene, and in that case, it is acceptable to retain this investigation at the hospital level. However, from experience, it is always recommended that if external expertise is available, then this would be recruited Infection Control Outbreak Team. Can we go to the next slide, please? What do infection control teams involve themselves whenever food poisoning outbreaks occur? Well, again, there are a number of useful reviews and descriptions, and it would make sense to most of us that a primary role for infection control professionals in such circumstances very often centers around proper isolation, whether it is single room isolation or else with greater numbers cohort isolation, when in every circumstance, very often it is the infection control nurse, one must say, who will be the spearhead and who will be actually managing displacement of patients within the different departments and ensuring that the way patients are placed does not put other non-affected patients at risk. In addition, any investigation of a foodborne illness by necessity involves an extensive amount of surveillance, both in picking up cases and especially in doing cultures and other laboratory sampling for microbiology. And in fact, it has been estimated that in such outbreak situations, this surveillance and sampling workload can actually increase by as much as 800%. Again, as with many other similar situations, education of both staff as well as public can and often is very important from an infection control point of view, and infection control practitioners and professionals will have to intervene and provide a certain amount of education in the process. We can go to the next slide, please. It must be said that foodborne mechanisms of spread are not the most common ways in which intestinal infections are transmitted. By far the most common remains person-to-person spread, especially when viral gastroenteritis is involved. In such situations, when person-to-person spread occurs, it is very often difficult to actually pinpoint the exact source, although in many cases, authors would agree that very often the outbreak starts with admission of a patient with an unrecognized community-acquired infection, which then, because of breakdown of infection control, amongst others, would result in transmission in the hospital setting. However, what is essential to point out is that although foodborne methods of spread are less common, accounting for about a third of such cases, when you assess the repercussions of such foodborne outbreaks, you will find that the mortality risk amongst patients who are involved in such an outbreak, that is foodborne, it is more than 3 times greater than when you have person-to-person spread. So this is obviously an important element. Next slide. So because of this, I believe, and if I wouldn't be here today, that there is a role, an important role, for infection control teams, infection control practitioners, in hospital food hygiene, and this would depend very much on the type of hospital catering adopted in the individual particular institution. If the food is outsourced, it is subcontracted to a commercial food supplier, food caterer. But in that case, the involvement of infection control teams will most often be concentrated on what we call due diligence, showing, therefore, that the hospital is doing all it can in order to prevent foodborne illness. Very often, this would involve supplier auditing, visits to the supplier to inspect the catering premises where food is being produced in order to verify that, in fact, food is being produced in a hygienic, professional manner, and then supervision at ward level once the food is brought into the hospital. On the other hand, if, and this is not uncommon in developing countries, if the food is produced in-house, that is, the hospital has its own kitchen, in that case, very often, the role of infection control teams is likely to be greater. How great or how much greater it is will depend primarily on whether other stakeholders are also involved. So therefore, if you have individuals employed by the hospital as professional catering managers, as food technologists, and as maybe environmental health officers, and in that case, it would be these people who would be undertaking the primary role. And the infection control side would probably have an ancillary, an adjoined role, mainly again supervision of management of food at ward level. However, and again, as not uncommonly present in low-resource settings, if there are none of these specialized catering professionals, then very often the infection control team or the infection control nurse will be the primary stakeholder in such a situation, and he or she will be responsible for the vast majority of initiatives for food hygiene. Next slide. Therefore, to summarize this part, there are various interventions that infection control teams can provide food hygiene and in foodborne illness. At its very basic, it would be intervention whenever you have suspected or confirmed cases of foodborne gastroenteritis, involvement in hospital food hygiene policy, and possibly auditing. And then this can extend, depending on the type and extent of catering in the hospital, up to extensive involvement in kitchen hygiene. I'll go to the next slide. As a result, because there is this diverse scenario, because there is a wide variety of possible interventions that infection control can task to provide in maintaining and ensuring effective food hygiene in the hospital, I believe it is important to have a basic concept of what such interventions would require. And I always make an analogy to a pyramid, what I call the food hygiene pyramid. The base of the pyramid, where most intervention would be required, would be training, followed by HACCP, which is something I will come into in a few minutes, and then systems of auditing, both of kitchen itself through inspection, as well as quality control by means of laboratory testing. Next slide. What about, therefore, training? Well, the concepts of prevention of foodborne illness is quite similar to the basic concepts of most nosocomial infection prevention and control. And for this reason, even if an infection control nurse or doctor would not have particular experience in food safety, the basic concept which we always try to put across often also apply to food hygiene. In addition, nowadays there are numerous aids and tools that one can consult and use in order to come up with effective training programs. I mean, these tools you can find electronically over the internet, you can find through numerous books, and there are even training packages readily set up with slides, videos, and even examination papers. So there's a wealth of assistance available. But whatever training package you are putting together, there are a few concepts which are really important to ensure that the audience understands. One of them, fundamentally, is the need for bacterial growth. The need that in any foodborne illness, particularly if it is bacterial in origin, things like Salmonella, Campylobacter, Staphylococcus aureus, all of these require bacterial proliferation. They require bacterial growth. And in order to achieve bacterial growth, to reach what we call the critical dose, which is required to cause infection, bacteria will need two important factors, namely temperature and time. In addition, it is also useful to really emphasize the issue of risk foods, whether risk because these foods are likely to be contaminated, or as risk because if they become contaminated, there is a high probability that they would result in symptomatic illness. And finally, as with general infection control and prevention, the role of cross-contamination and the combating of cross-contamination by effective hygiene. Hygiene both of a personal nature, particularly through hand washing, and hygiene of the environment through effective cleaning and disinfection. Next slide, please. What I find particularly useful when doing training in such circumstances is to go through what are acknowledged to be the most common causes of food poisoning. Because in this way, it enables the participants, who will obviously be food handlers, to actually visualize the concepts trying to be put across in a factual manner, in a manner that would approximate what they do on an everyday nature. So the importance of emphasis of, for example, the most common cause, preparation of food too far in advance. And then bringing together an interactive discussion on why this can occur, why food poisoning occurs, what factors would be involved, and how this would best be avoided in a practical manner. Similarly, by referring to the problems of storage of food temperature at ambient temperature, of food at ambient temperatures, of improper cooling, which is done too slowly, or ineffective reheating, serves very much as a useful exercise to go through the fundamentals of the food, of the temperature danger zone, of the area, of the zone of temperature, which ranges normally from around 8 degrees Celsius to 63 degrees Celsius, where food, if it is contaminated, would result in proliferation of bacteria. Next slide, please. However, training on its own is very often not sufficient. We all know from our experience in infection control that despite the best efforts in training, unless training is aided, is assisted by some means of management control, of administration control, then in this case, errors will occur. And for this reason, in food safety, the management system known as HACCP, which stands for Hazard Analysis of Critical Control Points, has been developed. And what HACCP tries to perform is, first of all, an analysis of what can go wrong, of potential hazards in the food production process. Then, this would be followed, once the hazards are identified, with determination of what are called critical control points. And these would be steps in the food preparation flow, where if contamination were to occur, there would be nothing after it to counteract or to eliminate it. Once you have identified these critical control points, the next step is to establish what needs to be limited, what is important to be present in order to ensure that at this point, contamination does not occur. Once these critical limits are established, they would have to be monitored. You need to monitor them continuously in order to make sure that they are being kept within the critical limits that has been set. And if the critical limits are exceeded in any manner, then corrective actions are immediately implemented in order to bring the critical limits back to their normal level. In all of this, one is required to maintain effective records of all monitoring interventions as well as corrective actions. And these records would regularly be audited and verified through inspection. And if, therefore, one can give one example, if, for example, a food item is identified to have a critical control point in its cold storage, so cold storage is a critical control point. The critical limit, because we said that the temperature danger zone starts from 6 to 8 degrees, would therefore establish having a storage temperature between 1 to 4 degrees. This would be regularly monitored, whether automatically or manually. And then, if it is found that this temperature has deviated from the acceptable range, immediate corrective action is undertaken. For example, by taking the food item and placing it in another cold room or refrigerator. So that is, in a nutshell, what HACCP requires. Next slide. This is nothing really new. It's been in place for many years, many decades. In fact, it dates back as far as the 1960s to the original NASA space program. And obviously, it was realized that the food quality and the food safety of the in-flight food items that would be eaten by the astronauts had to be extremely stringent. Nowadays, HACCP principles are incorporated into almost all food safety legislation, both in the United States as well as in the European Union. Next slide. Before HACCP can be implemented, there are a number of prerequisites that are required. There must be a statement of intent. The hospital must make it clear that it intends to have a HACCP system in place, and more importantly than that, provide the necessary funds for its implementation. There must be an effective skills base amongst the employees, both in the kitchen as well as anywhere where the food is distributed and served. There needs to be training in food hygiene itself, as well as training in HACCP. We need good quality raw materials, because the quality of the raw material obviously influences the quality of the end product. And in order to ensure that the quality is constant, a system of supplier approval is normally required. And then, in addition, there must be good hygienic practices, because these form the basis, the foundation of any HACCP implementation in kitchens. And this good hygiene practice must include issues like premises and layout, which must be good, amenable to safe food production. There must be effective hygiene, both of on a personal nature amongst the staff, and as well as equipment and premises. Next slide, please. These good hygiene practices, as I said, must be overall. You need to have standard operational procedures in place so that people know what they have to do. And in addition, log sheets in order to actually document cleaning processes. Facilities for hand hygiene must be there. You must have effective pest control in the kitchen involved, and a degree of equipment maintenance and cleaning checks. In addition, because staff, if they are carriers, can transmit infections to the food they are preparing, issues such as employee health questionnaires and reports of staff sickness are also part of the prerequisites of HACCP. Next slide. Now, I'd like to go very briefly over potential hazards that can occur in foods. Now, as people involved in infection control, we always tend to have some form of a bias towards biological hazards. Microbes such as bacteria, viruses, parasites, and correctly so, because in the vast majority of cases, hazards in food are actually biological. But there are also other hazards that one needs to keep in mind if involved in setting up a HACCP system. Chemical hazards, such as sanitizers and pesticides in foods, and hazards of a physical nature, such as bones, rocks, metals, etc. Next slide. Now, controlling biological hazards is relatively straightforward, although not necessarily always undertaken. But temperature is the ideal means by which biological hazards can be controlled. Heating and cooking, especially if you are able to achieve a temperature of at least 75 degrees Celsius for 1 minute in the thickest part of the item being cooked, being prepared, will almost certainly guarantee safety of that food from biological agents. In addition, it's not just a question of killing the organisms, it's also a question of not allowing any potential contaminants to grow. Therefore, as I have already alluded to, the need to maintain food at low temperatures less than 4 degrees Celsius, which prevents bacteria from multiplying. And if food has been cooked, and then it needs to be cooled in order to be stored, and the cooling process may depart within the temperature danger zone from, as I said, 63 to 64 degrees Celsius, needs to be done quickly, as quickly as possible, preferably using apparatus such as blast chillers, and always it should never take more than 45 to 60 minutes. Next slide. Control of chemical hazards is slightly more difficult, because it is not easy to ensure that this is being undertaken, and it is only if proper procedures are used, if the chemicals utilized in the kitchen are as required by law, particularly being of a food-grade quality, and if potential contaminants are stored and used separately from food production areas or food production instances. Only in this way, by good manufacturing practice, that chemical hazards can be controlled. Next slide. Physical hazards, on the other hand, are often removed in a physical way by, first of all, good sanitation and effective practices, but also using some barrier methods, such as using sieves, filters, or else metal detectors. Next slide. Now, whenever anyone is contemplating setting up a HACCP system, it is always important to make sure that the production is subdivided into each individual component of that production cycle, starting from purchase down through all the individual steps until the food is served to the patient, because this is a hospital setting. Next slide. Then, once you have performed and produced this flow diagram, as we call it, then each individual item in that flow diagram should be looked at in detail. Sometimes you actually have to go and see the food being produced. And as a result, you will establish what potential hazards can occur. Then once you have established the hazards, as you can see, you can actually set up effective control systems. So for example, if we look at storage, hazards can be mainly attributed to growth of food poisoning bacteria, toxins in already present food, and contamination. And as a result, your controls would very often be centered around effective storage at safe temperatures, things like wrapping, which will enable therefore or prevent contamination, stock rotation to make sure that stock is used regularly, and labeling of high-risk foods. On the other hand, if it's cooking, then as we said, it is mainly achievement of the required temperature to kill any pathogenic bacteria. Next slide. One area where infection control teams will very often be involved is at the end of the food production flow chart, that is at the service end, when the food is actually served in the ward to the patient. And very often over here, the vast majority of hazards are related to proliferation of organisms. And in this case, it is essential to identify whether the food will be served cold or is hot. If it is cold, then it is vital that the food is served to the patient, especially if it is of a high-risk nature, as soon as possible after removal from refrigerated storage. On the other hand, if it is a hot food, if it is food which is heated, then the food must be served above 63 degrees. So it must be kept at least above 63 degrees until it is ready to be served to the patient. Next slide. Is HACCP effective? Well, there is a wealth of information that shows that HACCP works, and it works in all circumstances. It works in restaurants, it works in hotels, and it also works in hospitals. In fact, there are not too many papers, to be honest, to show this, but one of them by Shanagi shows through food microbiology estimation the level of improvement that is achieved when HACCP is introduced, with a major improvement in bacterial counts and, very importantly, a significant improvement in the presence of bacteria E. coli, which can be pathogenic. Nevertheless, despite this, still you find situations where HACCP is not introduced. For example, one paper in Italy found that out of 27 hospitals which were interviewed, only about half of them actually had implemented a HACCP system. And the level of information, the level of knowledge about this food safety methods in healthcare workers, including in infection control personnel, was actually inferior to that amongst the food handlers themselves. So there is clearly areas of improvement to can look to in order to ensure better food safety in the hospital. Next slide. What about food testing? Well, this is very often a contentious subject, which many people debate, but as a general rule, food testing is significantly expensive because it's so labor intensive. If you're going to do it, most individuals, most experts will tell you, don't go for pathogen testing. Don't test routinely for Salmonella. It is not worth the money or the effort that you expend. If you want to do something, the best results, the most useful results are obtained if tests such as total bacterial counts, if tests such as for indicator organisms, such as E. coli. So these would be organisms which would indicate a poor hygiene state, which would therefore predispose to food poisoning by other pathogenic organisms. It's important to remember that even in the best of hands, there is a wide margin of error, with bacterial counts varying as much as one log above or below. So therefore, a test result of 1,000 bacteria colony-forming units per gram and another one of 100,000 may actually be the same thing. So what you're looking for is not single results, it's trends, long-term trends. So if you can't do it regularly, it's really something you should think about not doing in an actual fact. One very useful spin-off I find from regular testing, however, is the psychological effect it has on food handlers. Because very often we try to project abstract ideas about bacteria which these people actually cannot see, and they very often find difficult to comprehend. But if you actually show them results and show them improvements in the results following their efforts, this would actually have a useful psychological effect on them, and better compliance is very often encountered. Next slide, please. Just a small point about what potential tests can be done. As I said, the best two are the total bacterial count, not because it's an indicator of hygiene, but because it shows you the quality of the food. And most importantly, the E. coli count, the count of Escherichia coli, because this is an indicator of poor hygiene. Staphylococcus aureus very often originates from contamination by a carrier amongst the food handling staff, but this is not very common, and to be honest, again, it is not really cost effective. Salmonella and Campylobacter and other food poisoning organisms only really required if there is an outbreak situation. So the bottom line is, if you want to do just one test, then what I would suggest is the E. coli count, because this shows you the hygiene status of the food being tested. Next slide. What can actually be more useful definitely more cost-effective because it is much cheaper to do, is environmental swabbing, where you're basically taking a swab and swabbing different parts of the environment in the kitchen, such as work surfaces, such as equipment, such as hands of individuals who are preparing foods, and then these can be tested semi-quantitatively. So you don't have to do a rigmarole of fully quantitative tests, just a simple semi-quantitative analysis is very often sufficient. And what I found from experience is that if you're going to if there is a likelihood that anomalies will be found, it is very often by means of environmental swabbing. And as a result, it is quite cost-effective. It's a very useful tool to monitor hygiene in the kitchen and the production areas amongst the staff. And again, it's a useful tool in order to improve compliance and facilitate self-improvement within the food handling personnel. Next slide. What about routine tests on the food handlers themselves? Do food handlers require to go through regular, say, 6 monthly testing of feces, of nasal orifices for Staphylococcus aureus, for example? Well, again, much debate on this area, but what most people would agree upon is that this is, number one, not cost effective. It's not cost effective because even if you identify a carrier, this event is not likely to make a significant contribution. Just to further expand on this, even if someone is a carrier of Staph aureus in the nose, he or she would actually have to touch their noses and then touch their food before breaking 3 or 4 cardinal food hygiene rules in order for this to occur. Furthermore, even if someone is found to be negative, that individual may very well become a carrier the next day or next week or next month. And this may actually lead to a false sense of security in the individual who would be reassured by the test. And as a result, you can actually get negligence in general and personal hygiene practices. So I would suggest is that if you have the money to do routine testing of food handlers, that money, whatever it is, would be better invested in effective training programs for the employees, and you're more likely to get more return for your investment in that way. One area where, again, infection control personnel are often required to assist is in kitchen auditing. And for the unaccustomed, the first kitchen audit is a rather scary experience. But once again, if we keep in mind the cardinal causes of food poisoning, the preparation too far in advance, improper storage, cooling, reheating, etc., you can keep these in mind, and as you're going through the kitchen, try to identify whether there are any practices which would predispose to these situations. If this audit is likely to be undertaken on a regular basis, then it would be preferable to come up with an inspection sheet which incorporates all the different areas and all different functions within the kitchen, and score this sheet over and over again. In this way, you will have reproducibility, you will have standardization, and you will be actually capable of comparing and evaluating trends in compliance over the time period that you are conducting the audit. Finally, wards have kitchens too. Wards, or most wards at least, would have some form of kitchen where food is stored, heated, and possibly prepared, basically. And if you look at these kitchens, very often you will also find problems. As you can see, from the picture and slide, major problems of storage with cooked items stored next to high-risk raw item in eggs. Next slide. It is important that walled kitchens and refrigerators are kept clean. The fridges should be sited away from heat, have their temperature monitored regularly. Any items which are outdated, which are unlabeled, which are unwrapped or exposed, as we saw on the previous slide, should be immediately discarded. And always, it is important to make sure that effective separation is undertaken in order to prevent cross-contamination. If we have just one refrigerator, the best way to separate would be to have the cooked items placed always above the raw items, so that there will be no risk of contamination in this manner. Next slide. What about enteral feeding? Well, it's becoming more and more in use in hospitals worldwide. There are various ways in which enteral feeding can be undertaken, but one major and big problem is contamination of the feed. And this is common. Many publications, many papers have identified that this is a common issue, particularly in developing countries, where some assessments, as you can see from the slide, have actually implicated all of the feeds tested. 100% of the feeds tested were actually contaminated to levels which were unacceptable. So this is obviously an area where attention must be given to ensure contamination does not occur. Next slide. What can be done? Well, first of all, if you can afford it, if you can purchase it, commercially prepared feeds in pre-filled reservoirs are always recommended. If, for whatever reason, food must be prepared and liquidized in the ward or in the home, then scrupulous attention to hygiene is vital. The blenders that are used must be dismantled and washed in hot water and detergent and fully dried after each and every use. And needless to say, hand hygiene is extremely important before handling enteral feed systems. Next slide. The feed should be administered over a short a time as possible, avoiding direct contamination between the administration sets and any non-sterile object. If feeds are not used, they must be immediately refrigerated, and if not used within 24 hours, thrown away. All administration sets must be replaced on a 24-hour basis, and they should not be washed out and reused. And if intermittent feeding is being practiced, then the tubing must be flushed with plenty of clean water to eliminate all traces of food, which could therefore act as a source of bacterial proliferation. In conclusion, therefore, I hope I have been able to portray a situation where it is true, particularly in the world, in high-resource settings, problems with food safety, with food hygiene, are not common. But when they do occur, they are very costly. They are costly in terms of morbidity and mortality, and they are costly in terms of expenditure. The good thing about it is that in order to prevent them, we do need an investment, but that investment is of a limited nature. It is mainly concerned with preventive strategies, such as education. And this is, therefore, both a practical as well as a cost-effective option for healthcare facilities. Because as the saying goes, an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. I thank you very much for your attention.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Borge, for an excellent teleclass. As you mentioned in your opening comments, it's a topic that doesn't get much attention at conferences, but it really does have a significant impact on nosocomial infection. Particularly striking to me is the hugely increased mortality from foodborne illness. I think we'll probably hear more about this in coming years at conferences. Thank you very much. The list of teleclasses scheduled for 2005 is now on the website. And if you have registered as a full year subscriber, they're also in your members page. There will be approximately the same number of topics next year as there were this year, and the quality will be every bit as high. In fact, many of our favorite faculty are returning to give teleclasses next year. You will soon receive one or possibly two email messages from me about this. My thanks to all of you for joining us today. Thanks again to Johnson Diversey for their sponsorship. And a special thanks to Dr. Borge for shouting into his phone for the last hour so that we could learn about the impact of food hygiene in hospitals. To everyone, have a very safe holiday, and we will talk again in 2005. Goodbye.